interviewing Isabel Campos, because we understand that the other two gentlemen that are related to you in by marriage and so on are busy and unavailable, but you can kind of tell us a little bit about their story and your own story. Can I assume that you all are newcomers to New Braunfels, relatively speaking?
I am. I came in 1971.
Okay. So, well, that's newcomers when you know, when people figure things here. Why don't you tell us, you know, your complete maiden name, your parents, where you're from, when you were born, your children, your husband, and some of the biographical data, early childhood.
My full name is Maria Isabel Contreras de Campos. I was born in Guadalajara, Mexico, December 25th, 1955. I came to the United States in 1971 to New Braunfels High School as an exchange student. And the people that took care of me as an exchange student asked me to stay with them.
Who were they?
Their name was Dusty or Arthur Rhodes and Benedict Rhodes. And they lived here in New Braunfels, and that's how I came to New Braunfels. And I married Carlos Campos. He is born and raised in New Braunfels. He's the son of Victor and Victoria Campos, and they are also from New Braunfels. His great grandparents came to New Braunfels, and so they go back a few generations in this community.
Let me digress for a minute, because this is intriguing, and I always wanted to ask this question. Were you treated differently when you were from Guadalajara, Mexico, as to later when you were just another Mexican from New Braunfels?
I think there was a little bit of a difference in the way I was treated, also because I lived with an Anglo couple here in New Braunfels, and they taught me English and they would not let me speak with using contractions or any of the dialects. I had to speak proper English in order to learn the right way, and so they really treated me a little bit differently, because I was also expected to make straight A's, and I was placed into school 2 years behind schedule where I would have been, and I made straight A's because I had already had the classes. And so I was treated a little bit differently by school administrators and by teachers, but also by community people.
What made you come?
Those people that were my foster parents were in Mexico for 14 years, and I knew them. They lived in my neighborhood, and then they moved to the United States, and they were instrumental in my little community to start a school for children, because in Mexico the government will supply teachers, but you have to build the schools for the teachers. And so the American couples that live there, it's an Anglo community within the city of Guadalajara.
So it's Chapala?
It's Las Fuentes.
Las Fuentes, okay.
And it is an enclave kind of towards the south of Guadalajara, and there was they had very few rich Mexican people, but they had a lot of poor Mexican people, and they had a lot of Anglos. And we mainly worked in the Anglos' homes and worked the fields around that area. My father worked at a factory that was a paper goods factory that was in that little town.
What's his name?
His name is Eleodoro Contreras.
And your mother's?
And my mother's Maria Lopez.
Where was she from?
From Guadalajara also.
And your father?
From there. Okay. They're still there.
Okay.
And I'm the oldest of 8 children.
Ah.
First daughter.
Why didn't you go back?
It became very difficult for me to get adjusted to the lifestyle and in Mexico. I got very used to being here and to the food and to the culture of the United States, and to go back and live in the poverty that my parents lived in, and with no money to go do anything. There you have to go everywhere in the bus, and if you have no money, then there was nothing for me to do. They had no money to send me to school, and I figured if I went back that I would end up using my English language as a secretary, and that's mainly what I had planned to do. But the people that I live with, they offered to let me stay here and send me to college. And so when I would go back and stay the summers with my parents in Mexico. But then I would always get sick, I would always get the traveler's diarrhea, and I would get physically very ill from it. And my foster parents then became concerned about my health when I would go back, and I would get it just really bad the first 3 weeks I was there, I was just sick as a dog from just the flu that goes around when you are not used to the germs in the environment. And so then they asked me and begged my parents to let me stay here. And then I think as they got used to my being gone, and they let me go little by little.
Mm-hmm. When did you meet your husband, and why did you marry that one?
I met him in high school, and when I came here in 1971, the people that I lived with had a house on the Comal Creek, which is one of the tributaries here of the rivers, and we had a big flood in 1972 that was a 100-year flood for this area, and our house was flooded. And his father was a policeman in New Braunfels at that time, and Carlos was a teenager, he was in high school, and his father sent him over to see if we needed any help, because he knew the roads and their son-in-law who lived here in New Braunfels. And so just out of concern for us, he sent his son to help us clean up and pick up the debris and all that. And he walked in, and I met him there, and that's how we met. But we didn't date. He took me out once. They asked him if he would take me out. And I was so afraid of American men. I was afraid of every one of them. I was told in Mexico that they are too forward. They will try everything with a woman, and you should not trust them. Next thing you know, you're gonna find yourself in an alley, and they'll take advantage of you. So don't date American men. That's the way they are. They're not gentlemen. So I was really afraid to go out when I went out with him. He was my very first date.
Now, when they said American men, did they include even Chicanos?
Oh yeah, Mexican Americans are considered not Mexican. You they're pochos, or they're, you know, Mexican Americans, but they're not Mexicanos.
Okay.
So they're included in the ways of the Americans. And so I went out on a date with him, and I was really afraid. And so he picked me up, and we went out, and he said, we're gonna go out to eat. And I said, okay. So we went out to eat pizza. And he picked me up at 7 in the afternoon, and we went to eat pizza. And then I didn't know very much English. I spoke very little English, and he only spoke English to me. So I got some of the conversation, but I knew I was fluent in Spanish, but he didn't talk to me in Spanish. So, and I was very shy, I didn't talk at all. So I sat there and I just listened and nodded the whole meal. And then we finished eating, and he said, well, what would you like to do now? And I said, well, go home. So he had me home by 8. That was a real short. So I never went out with him again until my senior year. And some things have happened there to make some changes. And I had, throughout high school, I knew his father, and I got to meet some of his family. And through school also, I think they encouraged me to be active in social things in the community. And I started helping with the Comal Independent Men's Association, which is a Hispanic men's group in town. And they would have activities to raise money for scholarships. And his father and uncles were involved in that, and they sponsored me for Fair Queen on my junior year. And so I got to meet a lot of the men, and I would volunteer to go and help them at their booths when they sold tacos or whatever they were doing. I would go and help them in their booth. I just thought it was the least I could do. They were very nice to me. And so I got to meet his father, and he was there working in the booths also, and he and I got to be friends. And so when his son came home from college, his father told him he had to give me a call over the Christmas holidays, 1974.
Where did he go to college?
He went to 2 years at Shriner College. At that time it was a 2-year college. It was Shriner Institute. And he went there as a pre-dental student. And then one of his teachers convinced him to go pre-med. He thought that he could really do well in the medical field. He really encouraged him. He was a biology teacher. And so he went there for the 2 years. And when he got home for those holidays, and his father begged him, he was studying for his medical admissions test by then, by the Christmas holidays of of that second year. And his father told him, just put the book away. It's Christmas Eve. Go and call Isabel, she's just a mile away from here. You just get on this road and you go make a left at this mailbox and that's her house, here's her number, and he brought the phone and said, you call her right now. So he came over.
The matchmaker.
He came over on Christmas Eve, 1974, and he came and he came to my house. We didn't go out. He just came over and we ate dinner and we talked every night until he was going back to college. He came over and we were together every single day, pretty much all day. And we got engaged on January the 11th. And then we were engaged 3 years, so we just knew we had to hold off on getting married. So
you married him, and how many children do you have?
We have three. We have one that is 19 years old. He's at University of Michigan. He's a sophomore. And I have a 13-year-old son also.
He's what are their
Benjamin.
Names?
Juan Carlos is the oldest. Benjamin Benjamin is 13 years old, and Victoria is 9 years old.
Okay. Now tell me about your political involvement. When I say yours, I mean your husband and then your brother-in-law. Because we got to get those stories to how they got elected and how they've done what they've done and what they've done, since you're the only reporter we have.
Well, I think his family has always been really aware of the things that were going on in this community since his father was a policeman. He always kept those boys on the straight and narrow. He really went, he has five boys and a little girl, so he really had a presence in that home. And he was very well aware of the politics in the community, knowing what the police department was doing, the sheriff and all of that. He was very well connected as to what was going on. His son, Atanasio, is the middle, one of the middle of the boys. He went to University of Texas at Austin. And then he went on to become an attorney. And he was there during the demonstrations and, you know, where we had pictures of him with a beard and he's sitting up on top of a tree so they wouldn't cut it down on campus, you know, that he was involved in all those things. And so Carlos, being the youngest one, he watched all his brothers blaze some trails, I think, for education. His oldest brother is a physician also. He went to the University of Texas. And I think that he was a trailblazer in the family and showing them that it can be done. He was told flat out that he ought to just concentrate and go work at the mill. They needed good Mexicans to work there. The counselors at New Braunfels High School told Juan this, and it singed in his brain, and he still talks about it as it was, he couldn't believe it. And he said, just, I think to prove a point, he's gonna do it. And so he went to UT, and he graduated, and then he went to on to medical school, to Baylor College of Medicine. And then the second son, Victor, he's an insurance salesman, and he works for, he's an independent insurance agent. And then Nacho's the third child. So they were all geared towards going to college and finishing up. The rebel one is Daniel, and he went to school and then wanted to drop out and went to Vietnam. He wanted that experience, and nobody could hold him back. And so when he came back, then he finished college, and he's a teacher. And then Carlos came along. He's the baby of the family, and he is very aware of everything that went on and what his brothers had done. And I think he's always had a personality. He's very affable. You can talk to him and just feel like you immediately you know him. He has a real neat personality to be around him, a real good sense of humor and easygoing kind of guy. When we came back into town, he went to Baylor University after Shriner College. And right after that, we got married when he finished at Baylor. And he started medical school at Baylor in Houston. And I finished nursing school at the University of Texas and got my degree in nursing. And then I went to work. Before that, we lived on loans and it was meager. But then I had a job and it was wonderful to have money all of a sudden. We bought a car and we moved into a real house and instead of those little apartments that had roaches in them. It was really a good time. And then we decided to come back to New Braunfels. His older brother had tried to come home. And when he came to interview here, they told him that they did not need any more doctors, that we have plenty, no room for you. You wouldn't make it here. And I think he still, to this day, feels like he was discouraged by that and said, well, I'm going to go where they want me. And he went down to McAllen after he finished his residency at San Antonio. Then he went over there because they told him that there was no place for him. When Carlos was coming along, he decided he was going to come back here. He wasn't going to ask anybody if they needed him. He wasn't going to say, is there room for me? He knew there was not a Hispanic doctor in this community. There wasn't one for miles and miles around. So he knew that there was a need for a Latino here. And so he had already decided that when he was in medical school that he was coming back home here. And he did his residency at San Antonio. And then it was just in the plans to come here. And then one of the doctors in New Braunfels that had been a longtime friend of the family asked him to come to his office, and he offered to bring him into their group of doctors. And these were the established physicians. It was Dr. Woodward, who was a former mayor. He was on city council and pretty much every political office in this town, very well-connected man. Dr. Berger was also the same. He had held positions in the community and very well thought of across, you know, the whole state. He was also one of the presidents of the Republican Party, and so he was very well connected also. And Dr. Bergfeld was another physician that was in their group. It was the three of them. And he was wanting to retire, and so they offered Carlos to come in and buy his practice. So when Carlos came in, he came in on weekends at first and took over Dr. Bergfeld's practice in the community. And he right away filled up his office with patients when he started here. He opened his office full time in July 1984. And that was when my second son was born. So right away he just filled up his practice. He was very busy, and I think people really respected him very well. And things, you know, just kind of go along being a doctor for, like he says, making a living for a small family. And making a small living for a large family is one of his sayings. As we went along, I think that I took the role of being the person who took care of the children in the home. I made sure they did their homework, and I sent them to school, and I had all the dealings with the school system. I was in PTA, and I did everything I could to be involved in that way. Nacho had moved back into New Braunfels at that time, and he bought a house right above Landa Park, which is one of the prime spots in the area. And we were all elated that they were moving back to town, and so we went up to visit him, and it is a beautiful neighborhood. And Carlos struck up a friendship with the man across the street from him, and they really became real good friends. And the short of it is that the man sold us his house, so we live across the street from his brother in this little area of town. Those properties are very controlled by, I think, probably all the realtors, the chamber. Those are prime properties, and they were not happy that a Hispanic moved into one of those houses. Ooh. Now too, I remember when we moved there, my oldest son was about 9 years old, and he was driving down the street on his little bike, and he would go around the block and come back. And I was at the house, and I heard him screaming, and I walked outside, and he threw his bike out against the grass, and he was coming running. And I thought a bee had stung him. You know, he had that kind of a look in him, and he came inside, and he grabbed me, and I asked him, what's the matter? I finally got him to calm down. I said, what happened to you? And he said, I'm just mad. And somebody had stopped him on the street and said, little boy, come here. And he was on his bike, and he didn't get too close, but close enough to listen. And the guy said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm just riding my bike. And they said, well, you know what? You are the ugliest little Mexican I've ever seen, and you don't belong in this neighborhood. You better get on home. And he told me that he wanted to ram his bike on the car. He wanted to throw a rock. There was no rock to throw. He said, would it have been horrible if I had rammed my bike against their car? And I just, my heart just broke for him, because this is a little 9-year-old child, and somebody, an adult, would do that to him in that neighborhood. And I told him, well, it was somebody probably driving by, and, you know, just, there are some mean people, and, you know, just this isolated incident here, and this not think about it anymore. So he calmed down, but I think that it was an awful experience for him to have at that young of age. And so we went on to school, and he had several other incidents where people said mean things to him at school, just the kids. They would say things like, if he ran out of paper and he asked another little boy, can I borrow some paper? Or, do you have some paper that I can borrow? And he told him, I have paper, but it's not for Mexicans. Those little comments. And when he was in third or fourth grade, we moved to a public school. We had him in a Catholic school up to second grade, and we moved him to the public school because we wanted to work with the public school system. We decided that it would be best for us to work with the system, and if there were any problems, that we could work to make any changes that needed to be made, because it's easy for somebody who has money, a physician, to send their kids to private school and forget about the problems. It's very inviting, I think, for people who have money to do that and not deal with any problems, and you live well and to heck with everybody else. So we decided that we would put him into the public school and find out firsthand if there were any problems. And we felt like there couldn't be any problems. We have a real bright child. He's going to do well. He's scoring at the 98th percentile, 99th percentile. Oh, he's real smart. He'll do okay. Well, right away he noticed that all the Latino students, all the Hispanics, were in one class, and that there were none in his class. He was the only one. And it would bother him, and he would say, you know, those kids that are in the dumb classes, you know, Mom, why do they put them in a class, in a dumb class, and why do they call it the dumb classes? He says, I think that they're smart too, and why don't they put them in another class? So these things, it bothers me to have a child ask me that. You know, it's something that you have to really think about when a child asks you those questions, and you have to come up with some answers. And so at the time, you know, we really felt like we are the good Mexicans, you know, well, we're helpful to everybody, and we're smart, and we're helpful in the community, and everybody has respect for us, and so we can say something about it. Well, nobody really wants to hear you complain about the schools or what's going on. We just kind of went with the flow for a few more years, and it became more and more evident to me as a parent who went daily and who had my child in school that there was some things that were really wrong in the school system. There were those kids that he saw in those dumb classes in third and fourth grade were dropping off like flies in sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. They were no longer there. And there was no accountability for these kids. There was nobody who could tell you what happened to Johnny Zavala, who was in third grade. All of a sudden he saw, nobody knows at what point he dropped off or why he dropped out. And it would just bother me that there was just zero accountability for anyone. And I think some of the rules and the state laws that came down the line, they kind of give us a handle on asking the right questions. When they finally came down from the state and they said, you must have accountability for your dropouts. Back in 1987, they asked the school districts to have a committee in place to study the dropouts, how many people you had dropping out, and what the reasons were for the dropouts. They asked me to be on that committee because I was one of the good people, you know. They invited me to be in every committee that the school district had. So I went to this committee, and they gave me all the names of the people. There were two Hispanics on that committee, and they made the other Hispanic, who was a council member at that time, Ramon Chapa, Mr. Chapa. A real busy man. They asked him to be in charge of this committee, and there was pages that we had to fill out and send back to the state as to what we had found to be the problems with the dropouts in our school system. And a month went by and I didn't get a call as to when we were meeting, and I called the superintendent and I said, it seems pretty clear that we have to meet pretty quickly and that we have a lot of work to do, and I haven't had a call, and the deadline's coming up where we have to, I don't want to be rushed into doing something that is not going to be complete. You know, this is something we're going to send to the state. So He said, well, since we haven't had any luck getting the chairman to call a meeting, so would you like to be the chairman? And I said, I'd be happy to. So I called the meeting together and I gave everybody duties to do. I had principals on that list, and I had parents and I had teachers. And one of the board members was overseeing the committee, Ms. Jean Ward.
Yeah.
She was overseeing the committee. And so we gathered statistics on the dropouts, on how many were actual no-shows that we had no accountability for. We also followed up on the girls that were pregnant and how they were being treated at the school. They were saying that there were 3 pregnant girls at the school when there were really 23. The others were encouraged to drop out. They were told they couldn't come to school pregnant, so they just drop off and they wouldn't come.
They were all Mexican Americans?
A lot of them, the vast majority of them were. You know, they were the percentages are tremendous of the Hispanic girls that were pregnant. And so they were all just falling off the face of the earth, these kids. And so I made my report, and along with the report, we felt like it was important not only to identify some problems that we had, but also to give some solutions to the problems. And so I followed up for the pregnancy problem. And I went to daycare centers in the area, and I asked, because one of the big problems they had is, well, we can't have pregnant girls come and bring their babies to school. And so I decided I would contact daycare centers and ask them if they would take care of a baby for a girl in exchange for her going after school and do some work for them, maybe the latter half of the day, in exchange for babysitting. And we had several that agreed to do that, and I had their names and the contacts, and it was all in the agreement. And you know, that to me, it solved some of the problems that they said we were having. And so then we presented all this to the board, and Ms. Jean Ward, who was overseeing our committee, you know, they thanked us for the information and folded it up and sent it wherever they needed to send it. And she asked me there in public in front of everybody, she said, I think the information that you found on the reasons why some of these kids are dropping out, we did talk to some as to what was wrong, and it was attitudinal. You know, the attitude of the teachers, the attitude of the principals, the attitude of other kids towards us makes us feel unwelcome, and we would rather not go there. They don't like the way we dress, they don't like the way we talk, they don't like where we stand in the halls. It's just on and on and on, the same old problems. And so she said, I would like for you to present all of these to the principals at the schools. They're having a meeting, and I would like for you to come. And I said, absolutely, I'll do that. Well, they never called me. And I called them and I said, aren't they having a meeting? And I said, oh, well, I don't think they had one this month, but we'll call you next month. Well, they had one. The next month I called, when is the principal's meeting? Well, we don't have it set yet, but we'll let you know. And after that I decided they don't want to hear it. They don't want me to, for whatever reason, they don't want me to say it. And then that gave me a feeling of, you know, gave me a little jaundiced eye in looking at them as to what do they want from me? Why use me that way, and then, you know, not allow me to do some of the things that we could do? And they started being, I think, distrustful of me, but they still thought I was a good person. You know, still thought she's still a good Mexican, we can still get her onto our committees. And so I was. And they asked me then, when they mandated that all the schools have a site-based management committee made up of parents and teachers and the administrators to decide things for each individual school, they asked me to be on the one for the high school, and I agreed. And I served 1 year, and it was one of those experiences that just opens your eyes a little bit more as to the politics within schools, school districts, and what goes on behind the scenes on some of these things. The superintendent and the high school principal had a really bad relationship, and our committee got caught in the middle of it. The superintendent would do anything to not help that school. He didn't give them positions that they wanted. He didn't give them money that they needed. They let that school deteriorate. I think right now, if you were to look at it, you could see actual physical deterioration of the building, as well as more, you know, a morale deterioration. There was just a disregard for the school that went on because those two men did not like each other. The principal was there before the superintendent came, and he vowed that he would be there after he left. And the superintendent vowed when he came on that he would have his pick for principal for that school, and that that man was gonna go. And so they had this battle, and it waged behind the scenes all these years. Back in 1995, then the state is now tracking the dropouts by this point. They still have not done anything about the recommendations that we made to stem the dropouts that disappear. They still haven't done it. They're not answering to Sylvia. They didn't answer to anybody who had those questions. They just ignored it. If it was Sylvia asking those questions at the board meeting, they dismissed it as just one person asking a question, because it's just Sylvia, it's just her. She doesn't represent anything or anybody. She's a minority and she's just one person. And that's the way they treated it. There were kids that were dropping out for any number of reasons, and they allowed them to. They signed off on them. Because my husband is a medical doctor, he saw a lot of patients in his practice, and people tell him their problems, and they come to him with things that might seem that he has nothing to do with, like school problems. And the parents would say, well, you know, my son so-and-so, you know, he's really having a problem at school, and that's why I'm so depressed. And so then they would get into the school problems. And he had a lot of kids that he referred to psychologists because of problems generated at school, mistreatment at school. So we got some knowledge firsthand of problems that were happening at the high school. Then the state came down and said, labeled our school a low-performing school because of our dropout rate in 1995. And then along with that came instructions that these are some things you must do to remedy the situation. The school must have a committee, and that committee must find out why you're having these kids drop out, which was on my report to begin with in 1987. This is 8 years later. And they asked me to come to the meetings. You know, surprisingly, I was one Hispanic there, and there were two people that were also Hispanic that were administrative people with the school district. Everybody else in that room was Anglo, upper middle class Anglo. And the letter from the state said, you must ask the affected community. There was no one there from the affected community. There were no parents, there were no students. And I suggested to them that they make an effort to contact the students that had dropped out that we knew of, and their parents, and get a firsthand idea as to why they dropped out. They were asking us there in the room, what are some things that are contributing to the dropout rate? And this one woman, bless her heart, she got up and she said, now, wouldn't it be nice, easier, if do you want us to go interview some of these people that have dropped out and find out? And she was shushed, and they said, well, no, this, we've already taken care of all this problem. All of this is completely taken care of. It was a clerical error. A clerical error costs the state to judge the amount of dropouts that we had. The problem is that we need more clerical people, because we were overworked and some things just kind of slipped by, and it was just that we needed, but we have remedied that. There is no problem. So she gets up again and she says, well, it seems to me that what we're supposed to be doing is, as a committee, we're supposed to be doing these things that it says. And they said, this will be not necessary. We've already taken care of it. And that was Jeannie Mayo. She got up and she said, well, so what about these other meetings that we're having? And she said, well, if y'all want to have more meetings, we can, but the problem is already taken care of and there's nothing for us to do anymore. So we all filed out of that room quietly as we came. There was no follow-up. They presented the report to the board in the same way. They said, we found the problems. We have already filed our response. It was clerical. That came out in the newspaper. The problem was that we needed more clerical help. So then that made me really upset. And I went back to them and I said, I know that you have your problems, and that you can, for the state's sake, you have taken care of the problem so that you're not counted as the dropouts. But you have, the facts is that you have all these people out there that are dropouts. You have kids that are not being successful in school and they are going by the wayside and you're not taking care of them. You don't have a school for them to go to, an alternative school. You don't have anything. And you're not counting them. Well, they didn't want to hear that. So then they just a little battle one-on-one and just little, oh, well, everything will be okay. You know, don't worry about it. Things are going to get better. Once we get these other people, we're going to be able to follow those kids a little better. Well, I finally went to before the board. And I had tried before to go before the board. And they would always say, you're not on the agenda. I said, well, there's a place for new business. There's a place in there for open forum. Well, you have to be on the agenda. What are you going to speak about? I said, well, I just like to make some comments to the board. Well, you have to make a written request to be. Well, I'll make a written request, and they would, Mr. Bradbury would say, well, you have to have a majority on the board choose that item to be placed on the agenda. And I would go and sit down, and he would get off his platform, and he would give me this ugly stare. Then he would get off and come and talk to me and says, we don't have you on the agenda today. So I would just sit there and I would listen. And sometimes Naya would be there or other people. And I would just sit there and listen at the board meetings. And I watched how they treated Sylvia every time she asked a question. She would ask for a report and they would say, well, the state doesn't require us to give you that report. And it was on the, what was it that you asked for that one time? And Judy Cypher said, it was on the dropouts, wasn't it? Just flat out, well, the state...
Denying information to
this a board member in public, and the newspaper printed it,
okay.
What they said. Okay, this is New Braunfels. Only here can that happen. So I watched all this going, and one day they had open forum, and I was there. So I got up, and I started in on them, and I said, look, I have tried in many different ways to tell you that there is a problem, to tell you we have a very bad problem with our school system. And that I think it is racism, but I think that there is a lot of favoritism going on. And I like to tell you some of my personal experiences. I'm not going to sit here and tell you names of other people. I'm not going to go into what other children are experiencing, but let me just use my son as an example. Things that have happened to him at that school, as they have been over the last two and a half years, these are things that have happened to my son at the school. He had a kid that trailed him, and because he liked the girl that was Anglo, my son did. And that was a girl that he liked. And this kid just trailed him everywhere, stalked him, threatened to beat him up, had his friends threatened to beat him up, showed up at the band rehearsals where my son was and just stare and do this kind of thing. And I finally just told him that I was going to file a police report on him if he didn't stop. And I went to the principal and I told him, look, today is my last day that I'm going to put up with this. This has been going on long enough. This little kid is one of... They call it the neo-Nazi little group that they have here. They don't call it a gang because, you know, if they're Anglo kids, they're not in a gang. You get two Hispanic kids together and they're a gang, but not these little kids. And all the teachers even knew that they call themselves the neo-Nazi group. And I said, but I don't care what family he comes from, and I don't care his position or level of this community. I'm going to file a police report on him tomorrow. If he comes anywhere near my son again. I said, this is a mother coming in here and I don't want my son embarrassed by this. I don't want you to say your mommy's coming over here to look after you. I said, but this is bordering on very strange and this is bordering on very dangerous for my son. And I'm gonna make sure that nothing happens to him because nobody here is taking care of it. Everybody's laughing it off. In the halls, he's called a spick. In the halls, he's called a greaser. In front of teachers, in front of other people, nobody does anything about it. I said, I don't know what else to do except to tell you that these problems are going on. The principal one day over the intercom, in order to stem our Hispanic kids from congregating on one corner of the building, at lunchtime, they would stand by the wall, you know, since I was in high school, they'd always stand against the wall and talk. He came on the intercom and said that there was a group of kids in the school that were homosexuals. And these homosexuals hang out by the cafeteria at lunch. And you'll recognize them because they're standing against the wall with their leg up on the wall. And those that are looking for a male counterpart have their right leg up. And those who are looking for a female counterpart have their other leg up. And so this was all like a joke, but to discourage those kids from hanging out there.
You were telling me about your son being in the band.
My son Juan Carlos was in the band at New Braunfels High School, and he was well liked by the students and by the band directors. When I went to talk to Karen Simpson, I laid out all the problems that he had had at the high school, the incidents that we could recall that had happened to him.
And you had your husband with you?
No, at that first meeting I did not.
Okay.
And she told me, she listened and she wrote everything down. And then at the very end she said, I haven't heard you complain about the band director. I understand that she's a very difficult person and that there are a lot of people out to get her fired. And I haven't heard you say anything about that. What do you think? And I bristled because I had not mentioned anything about band or anything like that. And I started to think, why would she be asking me these questions? And I said, well, Karen, I really don't know why you're asking me about the band director. I said, there is one thing that my son has stressed to me and that is very important to him about his teachers and especially about the band program is that he understands that everyone in band, they have a tremendous band program. Everyone in band understands the rules. That band director has to get 250 kids marching on the field, on the same step, doing all kinds of designs on the field. Everybody knows they have to be on a certain foot, on a certain line, and they have to have discipline in order to accomplish that. They don't take any funny stuff on the field, or any horsing around, no laughing, no playing around. She is like a general, and he understands that. But the one thing that he tells me that he appreciates and respects about the band teacher is that it doesn't matter to her how rich, how poor, how black, how white, or brown you are on the band. All she's out there is she sees the little bodies and they're all the same to her and she treats them all accordingly. Everybody is on equal footing as far as she's concerned, and he has the utmost of respect for her because she can keep that up year after year after year without fail. I said, so I don't know. I said, I imagine that there are some people that have had their children disciplined by the band director and they don't like it. I said, he has seen disciplining going on and he tells me that and he says, but mom, you know, she's very even and she tells them ahead of time, this is what the rule is and don't break it. And then when they break it, she reminds them, remember I told you this is what the rule is and now you break it, now you have to sit out or you're out of the band. She didn't allow alcohol, you know, more or less what the rules are all over the place. Any infractions and you're out of the band. I said, so I really don't understand why you're trying to get a complaint out of me because it has nothing to do with it. Well, I was just wondering if you were going to complain about her. And I told my husband, I felt like she was trying to get something to use against my son so that then she could go to the band director and say, well, you know what this woman said? And it really bothered me. When he went up with me, we were going to discuss her findings. And we had Karen Simpson and Joe Parra, who was assistant in charge of special programs, Hispanic, the only one in the district administrative, and Carlos and I. And he was there, he heard everything that went on. In the letter, the principal wrote down, not us telling that the child said my son was the leader of the Mexican Mafia, he actually wrote it down in a paragraph as a fact. That my son was the leader of the Mexican Mafia. He had the names of the people involved and their parents. Everything was in that letter. And I was incensed. And I asked Joe Parra, I said, Joe, did you read this? Read that paragraph. And he looked at it and he went, I said, can you believe this? Do you believe that you see it in black and white, that it's written there as a fact? I couldn't believe it. I said, I am trying to talk to you about the dropouts and you are bringing it all back around and bringing incidents. And this is, I feel like I have a complaint here against my son and I'm defending him when it was not at all the intent that I set up to do. And my husband was there, and we agreed that, you know, this is ridiculous. And I told Karen, I said, give me a copy of this letter.
You have it?
No, she refused it. In front of Joe and in front of my husband, and she said, well, you know, it's really not mine to give. I said, no, but it's mine. I said, that is my letter. It has my name right here. It has my son's name. We are discussing a letter sent in regards to me, and I own this letter, and I need you to give me a copy of it. I tell you what, you can make a copy for yourself and not take this letter. Well, and then she got teary-eyed and says, well, you know how much I really care about you. If you wouldn't mind giving me the courtesy, you trust me, don't you? And I said, I hesitated, and I said, okay. And I figure, there's Joe and there's my husband. She's not going to deny this. I said, okay. She says, I'll have it to you within 2 days, but I really would like for Mr. Truman to send it to you, because it was, he generated it. I really would like for him to send that to you. I said, okay, I'll allow you that. The days went by and I didn't get the letter. And I called her back and she said, oh, you didn't get it? And I said, no. So then she called my husband and said, you know, and I was there at the office, and the other girls in the office heard it also. And this, she said, I am so sorry. I just don't know what to say. But he had deleted, when we finished our meeting, I threw the letter away. And Mr. Truman had deleted it from the computer. And it just doesn't exist anymore. And I am just so sorry. And I said, well, Karen, I think you have a problem. You have a real big problem, because when we were sitting there at the table, you had that letter. And as far as I'm concerned, you are the one that owes me that letter. And you had the duty to give it to me when I asked for it right then and there. Not Mr. Truman. It was, I was, as you asked, giving you the courtesy. And she said, well, I'll do the best I can by this afternoon. I'll see what I can do. So they went over there to the high school. And the counselors at the high school called me in and told me that Mr. Bradbury, the superintendent, and Karen, the assistant, were there on the computer with Mr. Truman. And they were working away. And then they gave me this letter. And they had expounded it. It was a longer letter. And they had taken out all the names. They left blanks. And they had worded that paragraph as saying, so-and-so, which was a blank by then, said that your son is the leader of the Mexican Mafia. And that's the letter that I got. And I fired off a letter to them, asking them to give me the real letter. And they sent that letter to their attorneys. And then I got a letter from them saying, no, they gave you the only letter that they had. And Joe would not cooperate. Joe would not say this happened. He said, when I asked him, I said, Joe, you were there? And he says, yes. And I said, are you willing to say what happened? And he said, not at this time.
So did that incense your husband to the point that he would run for office?
Not yet.
Get there?
But that was our experience. And then we met other people who had the similar experiences. And I told him, Carlos, this goes on. It isn't because I thought it was me. I thought it was, I'm Hispanic, and that's why but they do, you know, they think you're stupid. And they can get over all the stuff, get away with all the stuff. I said, they do that to a lot of people. I said, but you can't get people elected to the board because they transform them just like that. They can tell you, well, the state really doesn't want you to do that. You have to do it this way. This is how we do it. You know, you can't be against the law. You have to conform. You have to be a team player. You know, the state frowns on that. So I said, we need somebody with backbone to be in there and not allow them to sway you. We need somebody that will stand up and will speak what's right. And then this other man, Steve Weaver, had similar concerns over our building project. And he got lies told to him in black and white. And he went and asked. And so we got those two to run, and they had backbone, and they stood their ground, and they went through.
What did you do in that campaign, or how was that campaign organized? How many
that
volunteers,
campaign,
how much money did y'all spend?
That was one of the, we spent about $6,000 on the campaign.
It
was from friends, just, we put in a lot of our money into it, a lot of it, because we had the chamber against us, and we had people. They organized it, Mr. Bradbury and his cronies organized it so that they had the churches in the community. First Baptist Church in New Braunfels, and the First the Lutheran church in New Braunfels. They had the Lutheran minister run against Carlos, whose wife is the principal.
So your husband ran with a slate, or he ran by himself?
By himself.
Okay, but those others are running along
and
similar
then, right,
philosophies.
And Steve Weaver was running on another district that was also on, they had somebody not running there at all. He had one other person, but the incumbent wasn't running.
Did you all do any voter registration?
Yes.
Did you do any early voting?
Early voting, door to door. We raised funds. Mostly it was all these people that have been repressed for so long, for so many years, they were just fed up. And they got out door to door, and we had organized so that we had people calling people who called people. And it
are
was
these
like
new
a chain.
People or
new
the,
people.
All
new people.
The
Anglo community.
Anglo community.
Yeah.
Now, Carlos was elected from the oldest, most established Chamber of Commerce stronghold in New Braunfels. Overwhelmingly, we had 33% voter turnout.
Well, that suggests a lot of Anglos voted for.
They did. I mean, there were only, 200, less than 200 Hispanics in the district, and I think we might have 60 Hispanics vote. So,
you think he's going to be able to hold on to his seat?
I don't know if he wants to run again. There were a lot of things. We knew that once we got somebody new in the office of the superintendent that things would change, because it was just a can of worms in there.
But that hasn't happened?
Yes.
Oh, it has? When did that happen?
Right away, when Carlos and Steve got elected, they started a campaign to discredit their name and our name in the community. You know, it was in the newspaper. They spread rumors. They resurrected one about my son being a gang member, member of the Mexican Mafia, that we had discipline problems with him, and that's why he ran. These very, very ugly things. They brought the KKK to town. The KKK.
There was a rally here?
Yes.
Public? I wish I could get a paper clipping on
that. They're here.
All right.
And
give me one, I would appreciate it.
It is known that when Carlos announced, he told a few people that he was going to run back in March, and then within a week they announced that the rally was going to happen, that the KKK was coming to town. And we figured that some of these people are really close-knit Klansmen in town, and the Klansmen said that they were called by people in the community that they needed to recruit more people.
So
and that's why they had
95,
96? 90, that would happen in 96, 96 in June 24th, 96, they had the Klan rally.
Okay.
And a lot of people were, of course, upset that the Klan would choose this community and to come.
Did you get any threats at home on the phone?
Yeah, we got threats on the phone. We got indirect threats where somebody would overhear a threat and then tell us, oh, you know what so-and-so said, that you were threatened. My child, Juan Carlos, was threatened. They threatened to break his leg so that he couldn't walk across the stage. They vandalized his truck at the high school. They broke mirrors. They took things off, you know, scratched it, kicked it. They put chewing tobacco on the handles, the dog doo-doo, and that kind of thing, on the school parking lot at school. We had the signs vandalized. It was the
Has your husband practiced suffer?
No.
No? Have you been the target of any kind of persecution or repression?
No, I think that we knew we were braced for it. We knew that it was going to be bad, and we knew that we had to stand on our self-esteem and our self-worth. You know, that comes from deep inside, and that when you're doing something for your own self. Now, I did come to moments, I think, when I reached a breaking point of, this is just, how can they do this? You know, when my kids' lives are threatened, I think that's, you hit a bottom there. But till you realize that they're not going to follow through with it, because you know who they are.
I interrupted you. You were about to tell me the story about the superintendent being replaced, but we went off on this violence.
He knew that if Steve and Carlos were to get on the board, that Sylvia was not going to vote for his reassignment, because she had for his extension of his contract. He wanted a 3-year extension. He could have been smart, and he could have just ridden the wave and not requested those extensions, because he already had 3 years. He would have been here till 1999. But he was real an egotist, and he really wanted that extension as a show. He was going to do this. And so when Steve and Carlos got elected, that was his noticed that he needed to move on, and he started putting out applications everywhere, and he got a job outside. He got a job in December. So by Carlos and Steve got on in August, he did nothing to train them, to show them what the education code was, all the things that they're supposed to train new members. He didn't do any of that. He just refused to deal with them. He sabotaged them. He reassigned that principal at the high school and the assistant principal, and made the community feel that it was Steve and Carlos who did it. And what he did is, you know, the superintendents are given leeway to choose and pick their administrators and place them anywhere they want to, pay them any way they feel. The board has no say in the running of the school district. They just oversee things, but they don't have any direct say. He came to the board and asked them in executive session and then there in open session, and told them that this was for them to show him support, that these two more members, he wanted the board to show support for him by allowing him to reassign these two principals. So Carlos and Steve were willing to do that, because if they didn't, the next headlines were going to be, they are not willing to support our superintendent, he'd be a hero. And so they felt like they were between a rock and a hard place. Either they went along with it, and we really didn't want them there anyway. You know, they had done some really bad things. And so they voted to reassign. The vote was 6-1 to reassign them. The only one who did not want was Leo Chafin. And the very next day, they had a student walk out.
In favor of the principals,
of course. They riled up the kids. The Mexicans are in charge. They're taking over. Real bad racist comments being made.
These are Anglo kids walking out.
Everybody. Yeah. It was Anglo kids at first, but then they closed down the school. This is the principal, the assistant principal, and they have control. So they told everybody school was dismissed. Yeah. Kids went out, and then they told them, oh, you are supposed to meet in the cafeteria. So they all show up at the cafeteria. Coincidentally, all the TV cameras were there from San Antonio stations. You know, they knew that this was going to happen. They called them in, and then they acted like it was all spontaneous. And so then they had this walkout, and that created some hard feelings and some against Carlos and Steve, because that's the way they portrayed it. That now these, and they kept saying over and over, the Mexicans are taking over, the Mexicans are in control. And even Channel 12, Degollado, what was her name?
Jessie
Degollado, the reporter who came to report for Channel 12, in her introduction said, since New Braunfels now has a Hispanic majority on the board. And they never repeated that, but that wasn't true. No, there were only three. Mm-hmm. But that is the most that there's ever been, and it was a wake-up call. And then there was an all-out call after that election for city elections. We got to get control of our city, and we got to, you know, get all these Hispanics out. Because now they saw that as a sign that we're taking over. And there's only three of them on the board. And so Bradbury left, and we got a new superintendent in that I think first thing he's doing now, he's doing away with a lot of the tracking. He's just now beginning. He's here 6 months. So this is a beginning, and I'm really anxious to see what happens.
Can you tell me how the sister-in-law?
Diana.
Yeah. Her story, if you can, in a few words, how she got into it, why she ran, and how you all helped her, if you did.
Diana grew up here in New Braunfels, and she graduated from school, and since she graduated from high school, she went to work for Judge Clark here in New Braunfels. He is a district court? County clerk. County clerk, court.
Yeah.
Clark was the county court judge. And so she was his secretary for 18 years, and she was the clerk for him. And so she, more or less, you know how after so many years, the clerks really know a lot about what's going on in the courts, and she was able to prepare all his cases for him and schedule everything. And for all those years, she's 43 years old, and so since high school, she was doing that, and very knowledgeable as to the way the courts work. And they encouraged her. Judge Clark was going to be retiring, and he encouraged her and other people to run for the JP court. Which was not, there was nobody running for that, right? When she ran, she was unopposed. I think that.
So there wasn't much of a campaign.
No, there wasn't for her.
Not even a Republican opponent in November.
She was on a post.
Now the other JP, Vasquez, or Martinez. Who's the other JP?
Martinez.
Yeah, it's JP.
He's precinct
two.
What's his name?
Republican.
What?
Martinez, the Ranger.
Okay, well.
I really don't know. Okay. Don't know him.
What's Diana's maiden name?
Diana Guerrero.
Okay.
And then she married Nacho Campos 4 years ago.
Okay.
She's been the JP judge now. This year she's up for re-election, and she is having an opponent. So we're going to work on her campaign again to get her back.
Okay. Who do you think is the most effective Mexican American organization?
Well, just from my very short life here, I would think that LULAC has an effect in social things and social concerns, and I think the MALDEF has a stake and a big leadership, I think, in the education department.
Who is the most effective Mexican-American leader?
I would venture to just leave it local, and I would tell you that I think the Zamora family, Nayo Zamora, by all means, is a trailblazer in the community, and I think that he has, by doing that and the fact that he has brought his family into it, and he is leaving another generation to do it, that shows a lot for his leadership and all the things that he has done for our communities.
What are the most pressing issues facing the Mexican American community?
I think the education, but I think that it needs to be in the ownership that we should have in each other, and as Hispanos, as Latinos, to support each other. I think that I see a lot of divisiveness when one Hispanic wants to do something and the others go against them, and there is not cohesiveness in the community for that, and I think that our children suffer for that. We don't have cohesiveness to gather together as a group and help our young people, our young children. They don't know that we are here all together to help them. I think they feel really isolated, our kids do. And as individual parents, we can help our own kids, but we put them out in a community that is having these problems, and I think it's beneficial for us to support other Hispanics and other Latinos.
What do you think ought to be the relationship between Mexican Americans here and Mexicans?
It should be a brotherhood. I think we share very common threads from our beginnings. Besides our language and our customs, I think that we are a brotherhood, and I think we need to be supportive of each other and not so much have the animosity that I see. I see the Chicanos and Latinos looking down on Mexicanos, and likewise. It happens in Mexico against the Chicanos.
Have those attitudes from back when they warned you about all those Americanos, Mexican Americans included, changed them?
No.
Is there any final comment or statement or issue or thing you want to mention that I didn't give you an opportunity, because I'm winding down, I got to get back to that.
I really would like to see more Latinos visible, speaking out on the radio and TV about all the issues that affect us. You see people being quoted on any issue, they go to the black leaders and they go to the white leaders, but there's no word, there's no voice from the Latinos in the media. There's none at all. I don't see it. And you see the bad things.
I want to thank you and thank your husband and thank Diane Campos
in absentia.
And thank you, the Zamora family, for the interview. And it'll be ready soon, and it'll be in the book.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.